session number 3838, reel 3.
The Reverend Lieutenant Colonel Hickson, Reel 3. You were telling me about how English officers were taught the native language.
Yes. Well, we had the Qurani, who was the interpreter. From the every company had his own Qurani. He would teach a bit. And as I say, I used to have one of the Askari into my room in the afternoon or sometime, and he would tell me stories, let's say, children's stories or legends of his own tribe. It's very interesting.
Did other English officers learn the native language this way?
Yes, they all did, yes, I think so, yeah. And then we had to have a test, I think after 3 months it was.
Were these tests very stringent?
They were supervised by one of the officers, and I've forgotten who put us through the oral. I suppose it was one of the officers again, but the written test, I was the only one taking the test, and there was one officer supervising. We both fell asleep together, and anyway, I finished my written exam and passed it. I always remembered that.
Did any of you speak any of the native dialects?
I believe one or two chaps did, particularly those who'd been out on detachment and got into a different tribe. But the biggest roundabout Tabora, the tribe, they were all what they call Manumezi, who were a very big tribe in Tanzania. But very few of the officers really learned the language properly. There was one officer who'd been all his life in Africa, I think. He was absolutely fluent in both Swahili and Tunyandra, I think. But the ordinary officer went out, was all he could do was to sum up enough to speak the language of his troops, whatever his troops happened to speak.
Were your troops selected from particular tribes?
Yes, I think they were. Can't remember. There were the Yao, as I told you about. The Acholi were another one, I think. And there were another lot who were definitely cannibal, or had been. And they still had their teeth cut in a peculiar way, which I'm very proud of, actually. I can't remember their names now, I'm afraid.
Did the tribes carry any of their distinctions with them into the army? You mentioned these teeth.
The what?
You mentioned the teeth. Filed teeth. Were there any other instances?
Not
of
that I remember,
like that?
No.
To go back to your safari, were these sort of safaris unusual?
Oh, no, it was the ordinary way of getting about. And we had detachments at Mwanza and Masoko as well. Masoko was the head of Nyasa, Lake Nyasa, and Mwanza was the south end of Lake Victoria. And we walked. There was no other way of doing it. There was only one railway. We went straight from Dar es Salaam across the whole territory up to the Lake Tanganyika. Otherwise, there was no railway at all.
How did the Africans react to you as a fairly young European officer?
They looked upon me as a great joke at times. I think I tell you, they always called me Bwana Kadoga, which means little Bwana. And at times they nursed me. They saw me if I got into any trouble or anything. They were extremely loyal. As I say that to their officers, they were certainly to me.
I believe that some time after you arrived in Tanganyika, the appointment of a new commanding officer cost a certain amount of trouble.
Yes, we had the CO left just before I got there, and we didn't have a new CO for 6 months. And in the odd 6 months, we were looked after by the signaling board, who was a very good chap, and we all got on very well together at the same time, as we always had before. And then a new CO arrived. I don't know whether I'd better mention this, but he was a ranker officer of the Corps those days. He'd risen from the ranks. And he destroyed the happiness of that battalion, almost, really, in the shortest time I've ever seen. I think he was extremely tactless, actually. He jumped on me. He saw I was by far the youngest, which he didn't approve of, I don't think. He really led me a pretty nasty life. And it was the time when the Inspector General was coming out from England and his annual visit was coming, about more of whom more later. And he got all this CO got all sorts of preparations going, amongst which was an entirely put-up tactical scheme with live ammunition on the range, and he had to have some other country cleared for it, so they had to cut the bush down for it. And I was, as the youngest officer, was continually on fatigues in the afternoon. And the result of that was that one day I collapsed with a loud yell, literally in the mess, with fever, malaria. And I was whistled off to hospital. And I can remember the matron of the hospital, who was a very old lady who had been in the Tankadee for many years herself, knew what was what, saying, "Well, what do you expect if you will keep you out in the afternoon everywhere in the hot weather?" Which was perfectly true, of course. Anyway, the time came when we... I don't know, things got pretty difficult for me. When the Inspector General came out. Now, the Inspector General happened to be a general who had been in the same regiment as my own CO at home. I'll try not to name names. And I was to be wheeled up in front of the CO. This has all been taken down, is it?
Why were you to be wheeled up in front of him?
I've honestly been trying to remember what the actual accusation was, but I think it was simply that I was... I don't know what it was, really. What he told the Inspector General, I don't know. But I do remember Penn Galway sent me a message one evening and said, "Come along to my house at 6 o'clock, or one afternoon. Come along to my house about 6 o'clock in the evening. I want to see you." And I thought, well, I was on the mat again, as they say in the army. Instead of which, he was in his bath when I arrived, and he shouted to me to get him to take help myself to a whiskey and soda or something, which soothed me down a bit. And then he came out. I've always remembered this about him. He said, "Look," he said, "you're in a very nasty position, and I'm going to tell you exactly what to do," which he did. And he said, "Furthermore, I happen to know this the IG, the Inspector General's staff officer, very well, was with him. And he said, "I'll have a word with him." And it was he who really saved my reputation. I was duly wheeled up to the CO, to the Inspector General, and the CO, I suppose, gave his side of the question, and I gave my side of the question. And I remember the Inspector General said quite quietly, he said, "Well, I think you've come to the end of your first tour now. The best thing you can do is to go home." Well, that wasn't the end of it. And actually, all these people are dead now, so it doesn't really matter. But we duly went down to say goodbye to the Inspector General, having dined him out, and we took him down to the station. All of us, the whole mess, took him down. And he seized me by the arm when we were on the platform. He walked me right up to the end of the platform and said, now look, he said, I want you to come and see me as soon as you get home. Come and see, make a date with me at the colonial office. Which I accordingly did. And I always remember, he pulled a chair up to his desk for me, said, now sit down. He said, now tell me exactly what is going on in that battalion. So he tumbled to it pretty quickly. And I told him quite a lot, I think, really. But it just showed the sort of thing that could go on in those outlandish places we were in those days, I think. And if you got on the wrong side of your CO, you hadn't got a hope, which was just difficult, made impossible for you.
Whilst you were in Tanganyika, did you serve at any of the outposts?
Well, you see, our outstations were all the outposts we had, and I served, I think I've told you, in Dainoringan, which was, I suppose, about 200 miles or more from Tabora, at least. That was the only one, and unfortunately I ran there. I had another most unfortunate because they had, I was told that there was myself and one other officer, Ainsley Crook, who is now one of the Knights of Windsor and lives in Windsor Castle. He and I were there together as subalterns, and this boss, who was a pal of the CEO's. And I think he was out for me too by the time I arrived. Anyway, he sent me off to put a platoon through their annual weapon training, annual range course. And I went out with about 30 or 40 men, I suppose. And nobody had helped me, no other white officer at all, only the Karani, the African interpreter. So that I, for the sake of safety, stayed on the firing point and put the Karani up in the butts. And he did the marking. And the results were pretty lamentable. Because the Karani put down wherever he saw the holes of the bullets. And it was a pretty poor show. And I told the county commander, I said, look, it's a shocking business. Well, I took the real blame for it straight away. It mustn't have not put this, but the other subaltern I was with, say, took the platoon out and shot again and got the most marvellous results. The answer was too bad. But that, again, was used, you see, and I was sent back to Deborah after that. I had a pretty raw deal out there, looking back. And that's after nearly half a century's cogitation on the subject.
What effect did this sort of... Did this sort of thing have any effect on the African troops?
No.
What effect did it have on the European on your fellow officers?
There were two schools by that time, you see. There was one of the CO's bodies. It was quite distinct. I could name their names now, but I won't. And the other were the others, who were perfectly good ordinary officers and saw what was happening and, stood clear as far as they could. That was why it was very good of Ben Galway to step in. He knew damn well this was all going down. The CEO was frightened of him. Ben Galway knew a few people in England, including one of his own staff officers with him. And so it was.
What?
I'll tell you one thing that amused me. I went to see my own CEO when I got home. Before I saw the other one, the IG, and that my own CO, Walter Hill, actually died some years ago. I think he was chief instructor at the South College then. And he made some very trite remarks about having ranker officers in charge of African troops and things. Well, he knew the Inspector General very well. They were brother officers in the same regiment. And when I was ordered straight out to India, I had 2 months at home, I think, and then went out to India, the first battalion of my own regiment, thinking I was going to arrive with a pretty bad character, instead of which I arrived with an absolute wizard character. They both obviously put their heads together and sent a wonderful report of me out to my CO in India. But I don't know whether you want to put that all in.
How did the Africans notice that this new CO of yours was a ranker officer?
Oh no, they wouldn't have known that. But they noticed the difference in the man. I mean, they never said anything. They were extremely discreet, as you might say. But you could feel it sometimes. They didn't think an awful lot of him.
What sort of influence did he have on the battalion? In what ways?
What, on the regiment or the officers?
Yes, on the regiment.
I don't know. We just rather became sort of two camps in the mess, actually, which was a pity because there was nothing like it until he arrived. And that was all you could say about it, really.
So when did you return to England?
March 28.
And you'd been out in Africa for...?
Just under 2 years, actually, I was there. That was a tour, it was a full tour. I completed one tour.
And how do you look back on your time?
In Africa?
In retrospect.
I'm very happy out there, I think, in the first tour. Until this chap arrived out and spoiled it all for me. You see, he completely spoiled it. And I must have had over a year under him, I think, which wasn't much fun.
Were there any other non-African races out in Africa in wartime?
Yes, the shopkeepers, what shops there were, and the traders, were practically all Indian. There were some Greeks there. There was one old Greek who, he ran a pub. We used to go down and talk with him. He had a very pretty daughter, I remember. It was half the attraction, I suppose. But he was also extremely interested about Greek history, which interested me. He spoke quite good English. And I used to talk to him on that. But the vast majority, of course, were Indians. And they were, throughout East Africa, as we know now, because they have them back in England now, extremely good businessmen. I remember they gave a party for officers and their wives, the Indian merchants in the town in Iringa, which was quite a small place. And they had this party for the British officers and their wives. Oh, not their wives, there weren't any wives there. And on the table, the beautiful table laid out for us, there was a bottle of whiskey beside each man's side. But one saw that recently, you see, how they've expelled all those Indians. They all had British nationality, which is why most of them have come home to England. Come to England. They'd never been to India. There were a great many of them, of course.
Was there any trouble between the Indians and the Africans in your time?
No, not that I know of. I think the Indians kept the Africans at a pretty good distance, you know. They didn't have much to do with them. Socially, certainly. They employed some of them, I suppose.
When you came to leave Africa, I believe you gave your boy a present.
I gave him two blankets, which he thought was marvellous. Most people only gave him one. But he was a very good boy, actually, that one. He was the second. I had two boys. The first one was the one who got rid of his wife. I don't know why I got rid of him, but... and then I got this one, Kalume, who I knew was a very good... personal servant.
And he came to see you goodbye.
Yes, he came down to Dar es Salaam with me. and I was rowed out by the NCO and two soldiers, I think, from the 6th Battalion, who were in Dar es Salaam, in a rowing boat, and Kalumi had never seen the sea before, and he got into the boat and just cowered in the bottom of the boat, terrified. And when he came onto the ship, he took my baggage and brought it up onto the ship. He was quite amazed. He'd never seen anything like it in his life before. Of course, when I said I'd go downstairs and write his character for him, which he wanted, he didn't realize that I could even write on the boat. It was interesting to see how backward they were in those days. I should think they probably are still in many places. When I was out there, I believe the legend was in Tanganyika, there was only one African who'd passed a university course at home, I think, in England. Now, of course, there are a lot of them into fully educated.
Was there much lawlessness at all in your time?
Well, amongst the soldiers or the troops or the...
amongst the civilians.
Civilians? No, I don't think so. There were a lot of very ordinary offences which the district officers had to deal with, but no, there were no gangs or anything like that. There was no violence. I certainly never heard any. As I've said before, you could walk about any time of the day or night, wherever you went, and nobody minded. There was no danger at all.
And how did you feel when you... How did you feel about leaving Africa?
Well, I must admit I've had a rather jaundiced point of view by the time this year had finished with me, which was a pity. He spoilt my whole outlook on Africa. And when I was asked, or I wasn't asked, I was told I'd got to go back during the war, some 16 or 18 years later, I wasn't at all pleased about it.
Well, thank you very much, Lieutenant Colonel Hickson.